We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And another stellar week here in the...
Yeah, it just gets crazier and crazier, huh?
It does.
Yeah. Yeah, it... And as we have stated before, it's only going to get crazier from here till God knows when.
At least January.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah. So, all right. So, starting out with local news and the old saying that there's a new sheriff in town, but in this case, we're talking about the Seattle Police Department.
Yes, there is. Carmen Best is out as chief of the Seattle Police Department, and Adrian Diaz is in. That changeover happened on September 2nd. September 1st was Best's last day. Interim Chief Diaz announced on Wednesday, his first day on the job, that he's reassigning 100 officers from specialty units in the Seattle Police Department to street patrol. This came along with an admission that the department had too many specialty units, which were set up at the expense of 911 response. He didn't say which units would be losing officers, but the city council identified in July a number of specialty units that would take personnel cuts in their revised budget, which, of course, the mayor vetoed and the council will be discussing when it reconvenes this coming Tuesday. Among those units are the navigation team, harbor patrol, mounted patrol, public school liaison officers, event security, and sworn officers who work in public relations and media outreach units. Diaz mentioned traffic enforcement and community policing units, saying that some of their duties could be reassigned to patrol officers. He said that units involved in policing violent crime wouldn't be affected, including the homicide and gang units. Now, both Diaz and Mayor Durkin said that this move would allow officers on patrol to spend more time talking to community members and making contact with communities, you know, businesses, people who live in a neighborhood, et cetera, which is a major goal of community policing. It's also meant to cut down on overtime pay by providing more personnel to cover 911 calls. In addition, Diaz announced the creation of a fourth patrol shift from 3 p.m. to 1 a.m., and officers who would work that 10-hour shift would only work 4 days per week, so they wouldn't be logging overtime. Diaz said the changes would take effect on September 16th. He also said that his goal is to have at least half of the department's sworn officers and their supervisors on patrol. Currently, there are about 1,300 sworn officers in SPD, not counting recruits that haven't been sworn. So you have to be asking yourself this, which is what I'm definitely asking myself. What do over 650 of the sworn officers in the Seattle Police Department do if it's not patrol work? They can't all be administrators and detectives, right? Adrian Diaz, of course.
I have another question about that too, by the way.
Yeah, go ahead.
Why is there an active event unit when there haven't been any public events for 6 months?
Yeah, that was one of the things that that Mayor Durkin had proposed when she released her budget, is that that would be some of the money that hasn't been spent in the SPD budget that could be easily cut because those officers haven't been working events. Now, my question is, since there are officers assigned to a unit that specifically works events, what have those officers been doing?
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, Diaz didn't address the issue of why he's assigning more officers to patrol when over 56% of all 911 calls are related to nuisances and not criminal activity. And that's why the city council passed a bill in July that was sponsored by Andrew Lewis, Councilmember Andrew Lewis, that would set up a new civilian run unit to address those nuisance 911 calls and would be staffed by civilians, not by Seattle police. City Council Member Lisa Herbold, who chairs the council's Public Safety Committee, said this week that she thinks adding a fourth patrol shift would need to be approved by the Seattle Police Officers Guild as part of their upcoming contract negotiations. So there's also this question of every time we make a change to how the Seattle Police Department functions, does it have to be run by the union, you know? And does it have to be run by the court because we're under the consent decree? So there are those questions involved in these changes as well. So I also wanted to talk about a couple of really great articles this week that pertain to the subject of the Seattle Police Department. First on Erica C. Barnett's blog, The C is for Crank. She has hired a second reporter named Paul Kiefer to cover police issues, and he posted an article this week entitled, The City and County Keep Lists of Cops with Credibility Issues. Many of them remain on patrol. Now, it's a great add-on to the Seattle Times article that I talked about last week that looked at why cops who are fired often don't lose their certification with the state of Washington so they can go on and be rehired at other police departments within the state of Washington. That article pointed out that the state doesn't keep a database of all officers who are fired for misconduct in Washington state. It only keeps track of those that are referred by their supervisors for decertification, and are actually decertified, which is a minority of the officers who are fired in any given year. Kiefer's article, on the other hand, the one that I just mentioned posted this week, on the C is for Crank, discusses the problems with a database that's kept by the King County Prosecutor's Office and the City Attorney's Office of Seattle Police Department and King County Sheriff's Officers who've been disciplined for misconduct. It's called the Potential Impeachable Disclosure List, and it helps public prosecutors decide whether to bring charges in cases that were worked by officers whose testimony may not hold up in court because of their prior acts of dishonesty or misconduct and that they've been disciplined for. Kiefer found that there are 24 current Seattle Police Department officers on that list, and the vast majority of them are still working patrol jobs. The Seattle Police Department is still giving those officers annual pay raises, even though they can't testify in court, which is a major part of a patrol officer's job, right? There are an additional 51 Seattle Police Department officers on the list who are no longer employed with the SPD. Some were fired, some retired, and some resigned rather than face discipline. Stay on the job. Kiefer points out that some officers on the list have risen through the ranks. 8 of them are ranked sergeant or higher. That's about a third of the SPD officers on the list, including 2 captains whose base pay this year is more than $200,000 before you start counting their overtime pay. Okay. So here are police officers that the SPD is still employing, some of whom make well over $200,000, who can't do a very key part of their job, which is testify in court in cases that they work because they've been disciplined for misconduct, particularly misconduct that involves dishonesty, lying, you know, covering up evidence, etc. Now, the other article is one that involves officer pay. And this was another good article in the Seattle Times by a reporting team, 3 guys, Daniel Gilbert, Daniel Beekman, and Manuel Villa. It was published on Tuesday, and its title is A Seattle Police Officer's Extraordinary Pay Raises Questions SPD Can't Answer. It looks at the way the police department calculates overtime pay by examining the details of Officer Ron Willis's 2019 pay. Now, the typical full-time worker works 40 hours per week, right? And if you add that all up for the year, that's about 2,080 hours in any given year. According to the Seattle Police Department's records, Officer Ron Wills worked 4,149 hours in 2019. He was often paid for weeks in which he worked between 90 hours and 123 hours. And some days he was paid for more than 24 hours of work. Now, the Seattle Police Department.
Nice work if you can get it.
Oh, yeah. Now, the Seattle Police Department explains this by saying that they have to record overtime for a prior week all on one day in their system. excuse me, the Times reporters point out that SPD is still manually tracking officers' hours on paper slips, which makes it impossible to get a good analysis of total SPD overtime hours for any given time period. Like, for example, if you're trying to figure out 1 week or 1 month, how many overtime hours were worked, good luck, right? You have to go to their archive and pull out shoeboxes full of paper slips. Now, which is probably why it took three reporters to write this article, right? Now, 4 years ago, after a city audit found that the paper slip process was vulnerable to abuse, the Seattle Police Department started the process of moving from paper slips to an automated computerized system. But that project has stalled, and, you know, for obvious reasons, right? No one within the department wants to end the cash cow if they can help it. At the time of the audit in 2016, the city auditor found that at least 400 separate instances of potentially duplicate overtime payments were to be found in 2014, which was the year they were auditing. Currently, the Seattle Police Department has a policy that officers can't work more than 90 hours per week. But, of course, their system's not automated, so they don't have any way to track it and enforce that policy. And in some instances, officers were paid for more than 24 hours in a day because they worked on a day when they were also scheduled to receive pay for being on standby in case they were needed to be called in for an emergency. Essentially, they were paid for being in two places at the same time. And that's just part of what the city council, I think, really needs to dig into when they open up the black box of the Seattle Police Department budget. And I think when they do that in the 2021 budget later in September, when Mayor Durkan sends them in late September her 2021 budget, they're going to find a lot more nasty surprises like that in the SPD budget. So that's definitely an article worth checking out in the Seattle Times on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on that?
No.
Okay. Let's move over to the review of the King County Sheriff's Department.
Yeah. This week, a review commissioned by the King County Office of Law Enforcement Oversight found serious gaps in the internal investigation of Tommy Lay's killing by King County Sheriff's Deputy Cesar Molina. On the evening of June 14, 2017, Tommy Lay, a 17-year-old who was celebrating the night before his high school graduation, appeared to be having a bad acid trip. He was clutching a ballpoint pen and yelling incoherently about being the creator. Neighbors called the police, and two King County Sheriff's deputies showed up. What happened next is what's under dispute. Friends and family of Lay say that he was not violent, and when a third deputy, Cesar Molina, Molina showed up, he shot Lay without provocation. The deputies say that Lay attacked them with the ballpoint pen, which they, of course, thought was a knife, as cops think anything you have in your hand is a knife or a gun, apparently. However, the outside review has found that the deputies and the King County Sheriff's Office withheld important details from the public, including the fact that Lay was shot in the back, that Molina fired six times, and that Lay was all of 5 feet 4 inches tall and only 123 pounds soaking wet. In fact, he was smaller than I am, and I'm not a very big person. The three deputies, of course, are all much larger than him. The outside review also found serious problems with the King County Sheriff's Department's internal investigative process, that the force review board dragged its feet for months, spending most of that time searching for a non-existent knife in order to prove that Tommy Lay was a threat to the three much larger sheriff's deputies. They didn't even start interviewing the deputies until 5 weeks after the incident, and then they interviewed each of them for only 17 minutes apiece, not asking them any of the very important questions that should have been asked about the case. Finally, the Sheriff's Review Board ruled that the shooting was justified, that a ballpoint pen could be a potentially deadly weapon, and that, quote, deadly force still might have been an understandable outcome, end quote, which the outside review body said was a particularly troubling finding, and that the King County Sheriff's Department Force Review Board had some serious shortcomings that needed immediately to be addressed.
hey, the pin is mightier than the semi-automatic weapon.
Apparently. The King County's Public Safety Committee this week accepted the report, and Guillermo Zahle, who chairs the committee, newly elected, said, quote, "This seems like a clear obstruction of justice to me," end quote. And I would say he's right in that regard. King County Sheriff Mitzi Johannick apologized to Lay's family this week, but she tried to put the blame on former Sheriff John Urquhart. While Lay was shot when Urquhart was sheriff, Johannick actually has been heading the department during the investigation of his killing, and she could have at any time exercised at least some oversight over that process, and she did not. Lay's family has filed a civil rights lawsuit seeking $10 million in damages against King County. The case is set to go to trial, but a trial date has not been set yet. Won't be set probably till late September. So that's all I have on that topic.
But there was a lot more about police behaving badly this week. In Seattle on Monday, the SPD decided to sweep Cal Anderson Park, where people have been unhoused people have been hanging out. And there's something called a shelter house in which volunteers provide food, medical supplies, etc. Well, the city decided to sweep Cal Anderson Park. They welded the door of the shelter house shut after seizing all of the medical equipment and all of the food. And then as counter-protesters showed up protesting the sweep, literally ate the food in front of the people they just kicked out of their provisional homes.
It was
totally gratuitous. And, at a time when cop behavior is under a lot of scrutiny, you would think they would know better, but no. So that was Monday.
And while people in this city, obviously the homeless folks, but regular people in this city are having trouble getting food and being able to feed themselves. So,
yeah, and for that matter, there's a moratorium on evictions, but there's also the potential for a lot more homeless in the coming months. So if this is a preview of how SPD and Mayor Durkan intend to respond to that problem, it's not a good sign.
No, it really argues for having a whole different department of the city handle the city's response to homeless people, including a group of civilians who know how to interact with homeless folks and to help them get housing and to help them get fed, you know?
Yeah,
police officers who are going to do this kind of crap.
And why is it that it has to be volunteers who are offering food to the homeless? There should be programs that help with that.
Yeah.
But there aren't. On Friday, the Daily Morning March, which, there's two daily marches in Seattle, one in the morning, one in the evening. The morning march, blocked I-5, southbound lanes, just past the bridge that goes over, Portage Bay and Lake Union. And the Washington State Patrol responded by literally dragging people out of their vehicles. Several people were arrested. Nine people were arrested. Fortunately, they were all out by yesterday evening so that they didn't have to wait over the Labor Day weekend.
I think this happened after they had stopped blocking and they were starting to drive on and allow the traffic to flow again, that the police put up a barricade and blocked them and started arresting people, actually creating more of a blockage than the demonstrators could have.
Yeah, and while they were blocking, the demonstrators actually let through a couple of vehicles that had people with medical issues. Mm-hmm. So, it wasn't a strict blockade, but it did tie up traffic for sure. Washington State Patrol, they were caught on camera saying, we're not SPD. You think that the incident on July 4th where they didn't block an entrance ramp to I-5 when the evening march was there after midnight, early in the morning of July 4th, and a gentleman drove the wrong way, got on the freeway, and wound up killing one of the demonstrators. It almost came off like a revenge for making the State Patrol look bad in that situation. There is a real accountability issue with law enforcement at every level in this area. The SPD, the Sheriff's Office, the State Patrol, et cetera. And this is what people have been demonstrating about. And you would think that there would be an awareness that at least in this moment, law enforcement wants to be kind of hands off and not create these kind of situations because, you know, there's people filming all of this stuff and it gets around on social media and it really hurts their public image.
Sticking with the theme, I can't remember. The person who was killed in Portland a week ago, I can't remember if we reported on that last week or if that happened like right after the radio show was done.
No, it was the previous week, I believe.
Okay.
Patriot Prayer guy who was shot and killed in Portland. I believe it was 2 weeks ago tonight. The shooter in that case was named as a 48-year-old man named Michael Reinhold. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. And he was shot and killed in Lacey yesterday. I believe it was yesterday. No, it was Thursday night. There have been a lot of questions raised around that shooting as well. Now, the arrest warrant issued by Portland police for Mr. Reinhold painted a very different scenario or a narrative of what happened on that evening when a number of pro-Trump supporters went into downtown Portland in a caravan and confronted the evening BLM demonstration. According to the arrest warrant, Reinhold literally stalked two of the pro-Trump demonstrators. Aaron Danielson, also known as Jay Bishop, it was well known within the sort of militia scene in Portland and had a history of confronting BLM demonstrators with a gun. So there was good reason to be.
Can I just point out something really quickly here, something that a lot of people may not know, which is that protesters from the left have been subject a lot of times after their own demonstrations when the demonstration breaks up and, you know, there may be right-wing counter-protesters there or those guys might be pulled back a block or so away from the demonstration. As people leave the BLM demonstration, they get attacked by these right-wing vigilantes who stalk them and try to get them isolated and beat the crap out of them. So
yeah, that has happened often in Seattle, by the way.
And it's been going on for years. And I didn't see this necessarily as Reinhold stalking these two Patriot Prayer guys as being very cautious about two right-wing guys following him down the sidewalk. I would have done the same thing if I'd noticed two right-wing guys with Patriot Prayer hats following me. I would have ducked into a parking garage too. And just to make sure that they weren't actually trying to stalk and beat me up. So yeah, I don't see that video the same way these prosecutors do.
Yeah. And as I said, there's also video that calls that narrative into question. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty murky what actually happened, I think. And it's not going to be investigated now because Reinhold is dead and Danielson is dead.
One thing that's not murky, though, is that there was a live streamer who caught on videotape on his live stream what happened. And he has reviewed that video over and over again. And he says that from what he can see on the video, it looks like Danielson approached Reinhold and a friend and used bear mace on them before he was shot. So that appears to not be in question.
That is not in question. And one of the questions is whether, aside from the bear mace, whether Danielson was armed. That has not been made clear that I can tell. And then there's the question of Reinhold killing.
In the report I was reading from, the Seattle Times article yesterday links to it, states that he had a handgun in his waistband. So
yeah. So Reinhold. Reinhold had good reason to be afraid.
Yeah, they also found live rounds. The police also found live rounds in that gun that Danielson had, as well as additional rounds of ammunition on him. So it was pretty clear that he was armed, and that using bear mace on people, that's assault, man, and that can have serious consequences on a person's health. This is not, you know, a pepper ball fired by a police munition that lands some distance from you. That's serious assault.
And the day before Reinhold was shot, I believe on Wednesday, he gave an interview to Vice magazine in which he said he had no choice and it was self-defense. So whatever happened Thursday night, it was almost certainly not intended to be suicide by cop. The accounts, and there was video of this as well, were that a federal task force and some deputized Pierce County sheriff's deputies were basically ambushed him as he came out of an apartment that he was staying in Lacey, tried to get in his car, was descended upon by six or seven law enforcement officers.
In unmarked vehicles.
Yes.
I think from what I read, he got into his vehicle, had started it up, and was trying to leave, and unmarked vehicles blocked his way.
Exactly.
Witnesses said that they heard many, many rounds, 25 or 30 rounds of gunfire, but they didn't hear any shouted warnings or any demand that he stop, freeze, get out of his vehicle or anything. So that kind of raises the question of whether he was judicially assassinated by the Thurston County Police Department and the FBI.
Yeah, and Pierce County was involved as well.
Pierce County
does. And, it's a lot of people are questioning whether that was a straight up execution, and the different treatment that Reinhold was given compared to Kyle Rittenhouse, who was the 17-year-old who shot two protesters in Kenosha and walked past a number of policemen as he was walking away from that scene, and then was arrested without incident the next day in across the state line in Illinois. So, why was he treated very differently from Reinhold, who self-identified as Antifa, and of course the demonization of Antifa has been legion, starting with President Trump and all the way down through, various right-wing militia and law enforcement agencies. So, why was Reinhold considered so much more dangerous than Rittenhouse? Aside from age, it's really a double standard. But the man is now dead. He should have had the opportunity to go to trial and plead self defense. It would have been a very interesting trial, but that's not going to happen now.
Mm-hmm. And like.
Can I just say something here too? I just feel like the fact that people are to the level of shooting each other in the streets is completely unreasonable, you know. And this is just a comment I'm making about protesters on both sides. That if you're getting ready for a demonstration and you're taking a weapon with you, you need to sit down and cool down and. You're just not doing the right thing. You know, protest in this country does not involve taking a weapon to the street, you know, and we can't let that happen. And people on both the left and the right need to talk to the other folks in their group and say, hey, leave the guns at home, leave the bear mace at home. And I know that, and leave the fireworks at home. At this point, I think that's the only way we're going to get the level of confrontation to go down.
Yeah, and I honestly, I think that's wise, but I, and In Louisville this morning, I've been watching a live stream of the protests around the Kentucky Derby, and the cops are nowhere to be seen, and there's no barricades between the militia groups that are there and the BLM groups that are there, and they've been yelling at each other all morning, but it has stayed peaceful. And the conversations have actually been somewhat civil, even though they're at high volume. So, I mean, it is possible for protesters and counter-protesters to interact if they're doing it in good faith.
It is possible. And the leaders of these movements, the folks who organize them, the folks with the bullhorns, they need to tell the people in their groups, look, if you have a weapon, you need to go put it in your car, lock it up. It doesn't belong here. You know, yeah. If you're showing up armed to support Black Lives Matter, you're not supporting Black Lives. You're not supporting people of color by coming to the demonstration armed.
Yeah, you're just putting lives in danger.
And you're making
in your own group and the counter protesters.
Yeah, you're making it about yourself. You're not making it about people of color or supporting them.
Yeah. So. One other item in the cops behaving badly movement came out of Spokane this week, and it didn't get a lot of attention in Seattle, but people need to be aware of it, where a local co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America, who's been involved in BLM protests, was literally kidnapped and unmarked by what turned out to be sheriff's deputies in an unmarked van, and held for a day. Was not charged, and while he was being held, federal agents came to investigate him. This sounds an awful lot like what happened in Kenosha, what has happened previously in Portland, and it is now happening in our state. The Spokane County Sheriff, who has been notoriously critical of BLM, and was one of the primary people who spread the myth of Antifa coming in from out of town earlier in the protests in early June. He acknowledged that it was his sheriff's deputies who kidnapped the gentleman. They were in plain clothes. They did not identify themselves. They did not have a warrant of any kind. They just kidnapped him off the sidewalk. And this is something that people need to be aware of. That's a thing. We haven't seen it in Seattle yet, but I'm aware of. But I don't know if that means this is like a copycat kidnapping or if this is federally driven. Either one is a disturbing possibility.
All right. Well, let's move on to national and a story in The Atlantic that got some serious traction.
Oh yeah, it's pretty much dominated the news for the last couple of days. Jeffrey Goldberg's article in The Atlantic dropped Thursday night, and it was a bombshell. It was talking about basically the theme was Trump's personal contempt for people who serve in the military, and his complete inability to understand why anybody would do that, rather because there isn't anything in it for themselves particularly, and he simply cannot understand why somebody would want to dedicate their lives to a higher cause. Now, this has implications both for military service, for people who go into religious service, people who go work for nonprofits. He simply doesn't understand why people don't put themselves first and try and make as much money as possible. That's basically what it comes down to. So he was quoted in the story, and there were a number of really alarming anecdotes. His contempt for disabled veterans, he didn't want to see them in military parades because, quote, that's not a good look. Literally was standing at the side of the grave of John Kelly's son. This was before Kelly became chief of staff, but he was ranked high up in the Army at the time, and said, you know, why would anybody do that? What's in it for them? This he said to the father of a fallen soldier at the graveside in Arlington Cemetery. It's just stupefying. He was, of course, in the past called John McCain a loser for being shot down and being a POW. And he expressed, and this was not in the Atlantic article, it was in a follow-on article by the Washington Post, the Post and the Times, and even Fox News confirmed all of the details in the Atlantic article. That's one of the things that gave it such traction, is it was almost immediately, the AP had its confirmation out within a couple of hours, which suggests that the AP was working on the same story. Where was I? Oh God, there's so many bad things in here. Yeah, his refusal in 2019 to go to the 100th anniversary commemoration of the Battle of Belleau Wood, which is a critical battle that the U.S. Marines fought in World War I in France that turned back the German army from their attempt to go to Paris. This is an important part of Marine Corps lore. And he abruptly canceled his – he was already in France. He abruptly canceled his trip to that gravesite, and said at the time that because of bad weather, it was not safe to fly there and it was not safe for security reasons to drive. Well, it turns out that wasn't the reason at all. The reason was that he didn't want to potentially get his hair wet, which is, you know – for such a serious commemoration, that's an incredibly frivolous and self-centered reason. And he also, in that same trip, expressed the idea that people who were killed in battle were losers. You know, they weren't competent enough to avoid getting killed. He expressed similar things at different points about people who didn't evade the war in Vietnam, that they were too stupid to do so. And he also questioned why the United States made such an effort to find people who were missing in action, because they were losers who deserved what they got.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah, you don't have to be a militarist or, you know, infatuated with the military to see that as appalling. I mean, I've been a peace activist most of my life, but I respect people who put their bodies on the line and their futures on the line for a higher cause, no matter what that cause is, even if I don't agree with the military.
I come from a community where the military, you know, we lived in an area where there were two military bases, and in my high school there were a lot of kids who were recruited into the military right out of high school. It was one of the few job tracks available for didn't matter whether you were a person of color or a white kid, for kids graduating from a poor rural high school, so sure. I have a lot of respect for those folks. And I kind of feel like, yeah, there is a school to military pipeline as well as, I know in the city we talk about the school to prison pipeline for a lot of students of color and kids from low income communities. But where I came from in a rural community, it was school to military. And clearly Donald Trump has no comprehension of that.
No. And, my father was in World War II. My grandfather was in World War I, and they would be livid. And they were both lifelong Republicans, and they would be livid. And I think the significance of this, aside from, more insights into what a terrible human being our commander-in-chief is, and that he has really no business being a commander-in-chief with those kind of attitudes, it's got a lot of implications for the election, because this is something – I mean, Fox News also ran out and confirmed this story, and their viewers are not going to be happy with this by and large, unless you're a member of the Trump cult that is absolutely not open to any questioning of the great man. And we should point out that the White House has been scrambling to deny this story. They also had been quietly trying to put the Stars and Stripes, which is the enlisted soldiers newspaper that's been a part of the military since literally the Civil War. He wanted to shut it down. And part of this was that they had conducted a poll that showed that enlistees in the military now support Joe Biden by something like 56% to 44%, which is very different than previous polls have shown. Probably Trump's inaction on the Russian bounties on soldiers in Afghanistan had a lot to do with that. But this is going to cut in even further, not just to the support within the military, but also people who are veterans, people who are military families, et cetera. And So he had been trying to put the Stars and Stripes out of business. They were supposed to shut down on September 30th, and the White House abruptly walked that back yesterday because they immediately saw how damaging this story is potentially to his reelection chances. And that's the biggest significance right now, is that that is going to hurt him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just knowing what a terrible human being he is part of the problem, really.
Yeah. I want to talk, too, a little bit about Donald Trump's attempts to cut federal funding to anarchist jurisdictions.
Yes. Which is I had that one, too.
What he calls, and he calls it anarchist jurisdictions in his memo.
If only.
Yeah. It's his latest abuse of power. Trump instructed Russell Vought, the acting director of the Office of Management and Budget, one of his many acting directors, and Attorney General William Barr to identify Democratic-controlled cities that he can label anarchist jurisdictions with the goal of denying them federal funding. And Trump named his preferred candidates on that list as Portland, Seattle, New York City, and Washington, D.C.
Can I say something about those?
Go ahead. Those
challenges. Now, in terms of being a reaction to BLM protests, which this transparently is, there are at least four other jurisdictions that he could have named that also have Democratic governors and Democratic mayors. Those would be Louisville, Minneapolis, Kenosha, and I'm forgetting the fourth one. Los Angeles also.
Swing states that are critical for his reelection.
Well, no, where I was going with that was that Minnesota and Wisconsin are swing states, so he doesn't want to deny them funding, so
exactly.
That's off limits. Louisville, of course, is, Mitch McConnell is in a tough reelection fight, so that's off limits. And, Seattle, Portland, D.C. and New York City also are all run by people that Trump has publicly clashed with in the past. So he's particularly targeting them. He's targeting them for revenge, and he's targeting them to appeal to the base. This is a political stunt.
It's probably not
going to happen because it's completely illegal, which both Jay Inslee and Andrew Cuomo immediately noted.
Yeah.
But who's going to stop him, right?
Yeah, it also doesn't help that the state of Washington, for example, our attorney general has sued him. It's got to be at least 60 times. It's got to be well over 60 times, 60 different lawsuits
and has yet to lose one.
We've yet to lose one.
And New York's attorney general has a similar record. It's pretty telling.
So it's really part of Trump's doubling down on disorder strategy to try to win re-election. And it's a really desperate gambit because, you know, he's a desperate candidate at this point. I want to talk a little bit, too, about his status in the polls. Now, the mainstream media has been kind of careful about not publicizing a lot of presidential election polls because in 2016, the polls were mostly wrong. And, you know, there have been thousands of words written about why the polls were so wrong in 2016. But I think the main reasons are not hard to understand. Polls count the popular vote, which Hillary Clinton did win in 2016. But they don't reflect electoral votes, and they can't account for things like voter suppression and gerrymandering, right? But the polls do matter because that's how the campaigns measure their success or failure. The campaigns really don't have any other way to measure this except by internal polling and looking at the external polls. And the polls really help them determine.
I just want to say
the polls really help the campaigns determine and the candidates determine what the message of the campaign should be and how to shape that message and who to target.
And I would point out that the who to target is a very good indicator of how the campaigns think they're doing. And you've seen a number of swing states where the Trump campaign has pulled out of targeting ads, and a number of states that weren't considered swing states at least a few months ago where the Biden campaign has been investing in advertising. So that tells you that the campaign is going very badly for Trump.
There's
only so many votes that you can cheat on, right?
Right.
You know, obviously, in order to win, Biden has not just has not just to win the popular vote, not even just to have to win the electoral vote. He has to have a landslide because there's so many much potential monkey business.
Which it looks like he may have. Now, the recent polls have been very, very bad for Donald Trump. He's behind in all of the key states that he won against Clinton in 2016, including Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and even Florida, which typically has gone for Republicans, right?
And Texas and Georgia are in play as well as Arizona.
He's not just a little bit behind. The gap between him and Biden ranges from 8 points in Minnesota, and this is after the Republican convention when a Republican candidate would ordinarily get a boost, right, to 13 points behind in Pennsylvania. And he trails by 11 points in Michigan, 10 points in Wisconsin. He's behind in North Carolina, in Arizona, in Georgia. And he's neck and neck with Biden in Texas, a state that typically goes for a Republican candidate and is usually very easy for a Republican candidate to win. So he's not just a little bit behind. He is very, very far behind. And the gap is wide enough that the usual Republican ways of cheating, like voter suppression and gerrymandering, are just not going to work in his favor this time.
And I would also point out that there are a number of key Senate races where Trump is dragging down the Republican incumbent.
Yeah.
And that includes Iowa. That includes, of course, Susan Collins is in big trouble in Maine, Arizona, Colorado. There's two Senate races right now in Georgia, and those are both looking very tight. Georgia, of course, has not elected a statewide Republican in a long, long time. So this is something that is not good for Trump, but it is damaging the Republican Party all up and down the ticket. And that's going to be key, not just for control of the Senate and the House, but also state legislators, which will have control over the redistricting and gerrymandering potentially of districts with the 2020 census. And of course, Trump has been screwing with the census as well. And that's going to be a highly inaccurate census if, in fact, they close down the census prematurely.
Early, which is what they're trying to do. Yeah. So in terms of the polls and how that's affecting the messaging of Trump's reelection campaign, I think that's why we're seeing this big push to label Democratic cities as anarchist jurisdictions, but also maybe why he pushed the CDC this week to send out notices to public health officials across the U.S. to get ready to distribute a COVID-19 vaccine by late October or early November, which is far too early for any vaccine to be ready for distribution and to be tested as safe. And there are a number of companies that are developing COVID-19 vaccines who got together this weekend and said that they were going to issue a report. They were going to issue a press release on Monday or Tuesday saying that they will not release a vaccine before it has gone through safety trials and that will not be by early November. It's also why Donald Trump is attacking the Postal Service and why this week he urged his supporters to engage in a felony voter fraud by both mailing in a ballot and then going to the polls and voting in person. And of course, now he's attacking the financial stability of Democratic municipalities in attempt to, I think, also sabotage their ability to manage their elections. And of course, the president doesn't hold the power of the purse federally. It's Congress that does. So this order that he issued to cut federal funding to quote-unquote anarchist jurisdictions is highly unconstitutional. And, of course, I can foresee our attorney general, again, suing him in court for that and putting a stay on that order.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Moving on. There is apparently now a debate schedule for
There will be three debates between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. The first one will be Tuesday, September 29th at 5 p.m. Pacific time. That will be moderated by Chris Wallace, who anchors Fox News Sunday. So that's the one most likely to be favorable to Trump. Although he has tweeted many, many insults of Chris Wallace, so we'll see how that goes for him.
Yeah, and well, Wallace is one of the few actual reporters at Fox News,
yeah,
and has some independence. So that's It's sponsored by Fox News, but I wouldn't necessarily write it off as biased because of that.
Exactly. And then the second one will be October 15th on a Thursday, also at about 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. That one's going to be moderated by Steve Scully of C-SPAN, who hosts the call-in show Washington Journal on C-SPAN. That's going to take the format of a town hall where folks in Miami, Florida, and the surrounding region will pose questions to the candidates, and Scully will moderate that. That's gonna, I'm guessing, gonna be a virtual town hall. I'm not sure yet, but if it is, it means that that will exclude people who don't have great internet access or access to the technology to participate in virtual calls or virtual meetings. So I think that'll be a little bit skewed for that reason. The third debate's gonna be October 22nd. That's another Thursday, also at 5 p.m. Pacific time. That one's going to be moderated by Kristen Welker. She is a woman of color. She's the White House correspondent for NBC News. And both in her debate and the debate hosted by Chris Wallace, those two moderators will have the ability to choose the topics that they ask the candidates about, and they will choose their own questions. So that could be a very good debate, the third one, right before the election. And there's going to be one vice presidential debate. That one's going to be on Wednesday, October 7th, moderated by Susan Page. She's the Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. She's also the only print journalist among the four moderators, which I find kind of interesting, having come out of doing print myself.
Yep.
Oh.
Now, are the debates all going to be virtual, or are they going to be on the same stage?
That's a good question. We don't know yet. My guess is they will be virtual at this point. And at the very least, they will be recorded, so they'll be made available online after the fact if you can't sit down and actually watch them while they're happening.
Yeah, so if they're virtual, of course, it means that Donald Trump can't stalk Joe Biden the way he did Hillary Clinton.
Yes,
exactly.
Kind of physically intimidate the other candidate, which he likes to do.
Likes to try to do.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. John, I see we skipped over Black Lives Matter protests
in Rochester.
Yeah. I mentioned Louisville, of course, which has been going on the last couple of days. We also had some bad shootings this past week. Monday night in Los Angeles, police killed a 29-year-old black man. Police had been riding by him. He was riding down the street on his bicycle, and they decided to detain him for a vehicle code violation. I don't know, and they have the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office has not clarified what that would be for somebody riding a bicycle. But when they got out and asked him to stop, he dropped the bicycle and ran, and they wound up shooting him in the back. And there were a number of protests around that.
I have a tip for police who are saying, you know, why are you picking on me? You know, we do a hard job, et cetera. Here's my tip for you. If somebody's running away, don't shoot them in the back. Don't shoot them in the back. I chase them, you know, tase them. Don't shoot them with live ammunition in the back.
And we had another shooting in the back in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday of a 17-year-old or 18-year-old. It's not clear which. He wound up, being armed. But he was turning away and had actually thrown away the gun at the time that he was shot. So there were community protests around that. And then also in Rochester on Wednesday, we found out about a killing that actually happened last April of a mentally disturbed man, again, African-American man named Daniel Prude, who was asphyxiated in a situation that looked very similar to what happened to George Floyd, except in this case, he was having some sort of a breakdown, and so they put a what's called a spit hood over him because they were concerned that he might have COVID, which is understandable. And then they asphyxiated him in the course of about 3 minutes.
Wow. apparently he was on PCP. He was freaking out. They didn't have anybody on site who could deal with someone going through a mental health issue. So when they put the hood on him, he really freaked out, and they took him to the ground and placed him on his stomach again with his arms in handcuffs behind his back. And it was a George Floyd situation all over again, where they put weight on his body and he suffocated.
And it took them, 5 months to release the body cam footage, which is what happened this week.
And it took a lawsuit by the family to force the release of that body cam video.
Yeah. So it was a bad week for cops acting out, but we did have one positive thing, which is a San Leandro, California policeman who was charged with second-degree manslaughter. This was also a killing that happened last spring, in which very similar to the Jeff Nelson case that we talked about in Auburn a couple weeks ago, where somebody was confronted in a store. He was literally shot in the back as he was running away, once again. That gentleman is now being charged, which is a good thing. There was one other one this week too now, and I'm trying to remember what it was, but they're all running together at a point. And, you know, as I said earlier, you would think that if you were a law enforcement officer, and this had been going on, since May, that you would really be in good behavior, and you would really be getting guidance within your department to be to be absolutely certain before you're using deadly force, because you know the cameras are everywhere at this point, and the local departments across the country have lost the trust of a lot of their communities, especially communities of color. And that does not make the job easier for law enforcement officers. So I really don't understand why that's so difficult to understand, but apparently it is.
All right. We only have a couple minutes left. Job, you could touch on some COVID-19 updates and then segue to events.
Sure. We're still in the middle of a pandemic. The modeling department at University of Washington put out a new estimate last night that estimates that we may have upwards of 410,000 deaths in the United States by the end of the year, and that the number of deaths worldwide may triple by the end of the year to an additional 1.9 million deaths. So we're really in an alarming situation, especially in the United States, where the federal government really has given up on trying to do anything about the pandemic other than just ride it out. We have a number of problems, number of problem areas. And if you may remember, Maria already talked a little bit about Trump's promise to have a vaccine by next month, which is literally impossible.
And I do just want to point out there is one vaccine people can get that they should be getting right now, and that's a flu shot, because much of those deaths that the CDC universities are estimating is because of complications from the flu and on top of COVID-19. So if you get a flu shot, you're going a long ways towards helping cut down the number of deaths.
Absolutely. We have an example already of what happens when you run out a vaccine too early. And it's Russia, not surprisingly, the country that Donald Trump seems to get all his instructions from. They announced last month that they had a vaccine that they were rolling out, and a lot of public health officials and a lot of infectious disease experts were very skeptical of that because Russia had not published any of the data from any of its trials of this vaccine, and they hadn't finished the trials yet. We got data a couple of days ago. We got data from the stage 1 and 2 trials of the vaccine. And the good news is that the vaccine does produce antibodies in the body. So it is effective, potentially. We don't really know because there wasn't a control group in those studies, and because there were fewer than 100 volunteer participants.
Oh, man.
But so you don't, and they had not started the phase three trial, which is a really large one where you have tens of thousands of people, and that's a large enough sample size that you can find out whether there's side effects in subgroups. So we know that it's potentially effective. That's a good thing. We do not know at all whether it is safe or not. And two-thirds of vaccines in development are eliminated for that reason in stage three trials. So we have no idea, and Russians have no idea, whether the vaccine they're being offered is safe or not, and really don't know whether it's effective or not either.
That's
what Trump's trying to do also.
Okay.
That's what Trump's trying to do also.